want to begin with paying homage to the Buddha. Bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we're coming towards the end of June, and July 4th is coming up, which is a big day in America. And it's also the full moon of July, which is a big day in monasteries. Yes. So 4th of July this year is a big day for us in the monastery as well as the American Independence Day. And the full moon of July is Asala Puja, and it's the commemoration of the day that the Buddha gave the first teaching that was understood. So the first turning of the wheel of Dhamma. So it's a very special day for all of us, really. And it's kind of wonderful that we still, that we have a day, even though we can't say for sure, yes, Buddha was teaching on that day, but still there's a day that every year we recollect that event where this man who'd struggled for so many years to find the freedom that he knew was possible. And he didn't stop until he found just the right way. And then, once and then he gained full enlightenment and dwelt for some time in the bliss of enlightenment, and then went off to teach, spread the Dhamma. And we know that the story goes that he wasn't immediately enthusiastic about teaching, that at first he wanted to just quietly meditate and enjoy the insight that he'd had and just rest in that bliss of enlightenment. And there was a request from the Brahma god Sahampati, please, out of compassion to beings, those with little dust in their eyes, please teach the Dhamma. So the story goes that he set off walking along the road, and he met somebody, and the first person he met was just another wanderer, another person walking the road, and this person was impressed by his countenance, his radiance, and his serenity, and asked him who he was and who his teacher was. And then he said, I actually don't remember the exact words, but he said something like, I am the I have no teacher, I am the enlightened one, I am the supreme one, or something like this. And the man was like, oh yeah, okay, have a nice day, and went off, turned off down a different street. And so that wasn't a successful first transmission. So then he thought about who would be best to teach, who would be ready to understand the teachings. He thought of first one meditation master who was adept in the jhanas, and he used his psychic powers to see, like, where is he now? And he found that he had died just shortly before, so he'd missed the opportunity to receive his teaching. He thought about the other jhana master who he'd practiced under during his endeavors towards enlightenment, and he had died just the night before. So Both of these great teachers missed the opportunity to meet the Buddha and hear the teachings from him. And then he remembered the five ascetics who he'd lived with and practiced with for years, and went to the deer park and where they were living, and saw them and approached them with a wish to share his insight with them, because he felt that they may understand. And you know, the story is that they saw him coming and didn't want to receive him, because they thought of him as a slacker, you know, who'd given up the ascetic life for the comfortable life of comfort and wasn't worthy of their respect. So they were like, no, we won't set up a seat for him, we won't welcome him. And then as he approaches them, he's so beautiful that they can't help themselves. And then they can see it and they welcome him and they give him water. And then at some point during this time together, he teaches them the middle way, the path between the two extremes, and the Four Noble Truths, the path to liberation. And as he's giving this teaching, one of those five, Kondanya, understands deeply understands, and realizes stream entry. So in that moment of Kondanya realizing stream entry, the wheel of Dhamma begins turning. And then, as we know, the Buddha carried on teaching, and more people gained insight and understood and gained various levels of awakening through the teaching and the practice. And in those days, it seemed like people were very ripe for that teaching, so they were getting enlightened all over the place. These days, we have to work harder, much, much harder. And we don't have a Buddha to shine the way, you know, in person. Now we do have his teachings and can bring up a sanya, a sense of like a perception of the Buddha, can be really uplifting and very beautiful. Just to know of, you know, somebody like this lived and walked and taught and spent time with people and cared about people's awakening. So Asalapuja, the full moon of July, which is the 4th of July, is the day to celebrate that event. And that wheel of Dhamma is still turning to this day, which is an amazing thing. And we were chanting the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta yesterday, which is the sutta that tells that story of the Buddha teaching the five ascetics. And a line that jumped out of me at me was where the devas are calling out to each other. They're all celebrating the fact that the Buddha's enlightened them, that Kondanya has heard the teaching. And then it says the wheel of Dhamma was set in motion and cannot be stopped by any being, not by human beings, not by devas, not by anyone in any realm. These teachings, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma cannot be stopped. So nobody can make it stop, which is kind of wonderful. But of course, like all things, it will stop at one time, at one point. So it's not in danger of being, you know, shut down. If somebody has insight, you can't take that away. If somebody has a calling to practice, you can't stop them from doing it. They're going to find a way. And it can't be stopped, but it can demise, and there will be a time when it ends. And it's through negligence, you know, through not taking care of the Dhamma, not practicing the Dhamma, not studying the Dhamma, not listening to the Dhamma, not discussing the Dhamma, not reflecting on the Dhamma. You know, it's through neglecting these things that it starts to wane. So we can experience that in our own lives. You know, if we're not really taking care of it, then we're busy with the 10,000 things of the world, which are always calling and pulling at us. Then it starts to wane in our own heart and mind. And then when we pay attention to it and take care of it, then it gets strong and clear, and we see it in everything, because it is everywhere. The Dhamma is, you know, everything is teaching the Dhamma all the time. You know, this body that we're with every moment of every day is teaching the Dhamma all the time. The forest that we live in is constantly teaching the Dhamma. Everything around us is teaching the Dhamma. When I drink a glass of water, there's Dhamma in the glass of water, in the drinking. External water element becomes internal water element for a while, you know. So there's the teaching of the impermanence of not self, of dukkha, that we can't hold on to anything, is always here, always with us. And so it's just a case of remembering, not just, but it's very important to remember. Actually, just to remember, to remember, to remember that the Dhamma is right here teaching all the time. So it's easy to get lost in the thoughts. You know, we have our personalities, which are always a little kind of inconvenient. And they kind of knock up against other people's personalities, or they get drawn to other people's personalities. And, you know, those are the, in a way, like the clothing that we wear during this life to have to appear in some way, shape or form. And then there's the deeper wisdom or knowing or Dhamma or truth that is seen and understood and heard when we still our body and mind, when we settle, and when we remember to look in the right way. And, you know, in the monastery, we surround ourselves with reminders. The robe is a reminder. Shaving our head regularly is a reminder. Behind me is Buddha and Mahabhajapati. These are reminders. And we're in the library, surrounded by Dhamma books, you know, some reminders. So we, and then we see each other also, and speaking to each other. It can be, sometimes there's obviously reminders about the things we need to do and the worldly things that need to be attended to. There's also the reminders in relation to the path. So, you know, an important aspect of the path is to be open to receive feedback, admonishment, guidance, and if one isn't, then it slows the path down an awful lot, because then our sense of self gets to have things the way we want, or thinks it should be the way we want, or, you know, believes it should be the way we want, rather than recognizing there are many, many ways. And if I get what I want, she's not going to get what she wants. So it could be. So they're learning how to recognize the push and the pull of wanting things to be the way we think they should be, and then being open to letting that go. I'm talking about, you know, at a home, in small things, in small matters, and between each other. And I was reflecting also on Independence Day, you know, and what that means, to be independent, to be free from, essentially, I think what it's pointing to is to be free from those who became oppressive. So for America, it was the British. So to be free from those who were making constraints that were no longer helpful, beneficial, that were exploitative. And at this time in the world now, it's like a very amazing time we're in, very chaotic and very amazing. Where there's, first of all, obviously COVID, which is causing enormous changes to all of our lives. And then there's the huge and so far quite consistent reaction against racism, against deeply ingrained systemic racism here and in the UK. I don't know about other countries, but I know that here and in the UK it's very very alive and very strong, very powerful. And these images, like these statues, which were once seen, to white people in positions of power and privilege, were seen as their great heroes, and now being toppled because they are seen as oppressors. So I was reflecting on that. It's like, oh, this is a time when all of these metal statues, big heavy metal symbols of oppression that have been a symbol of oppression to many people, are being toppled, are being pulled down, because there's a wish for a new world order, for want of a better phrase. And it's an exciting time and a chaotic time. And it has a sort of it has a sense of naturalness. It has a sense of like, this has been bubbling away for a long time, and now it's really starting to shift things, that people are not letting this go back to sleep. I mean, we've been involved in local demonstrations, and for me, it feels very important to be part of this. It's not something I can say, I'm just going to sit and meditate and let it go by. Although I could say that, but it's not doesn't feel right to me to say that. There's too much sense of like, no, I'm part of the creation of this in some way, and I want to be part of the deconstruction of it also. And then that also applies to the inner experience. And the Buddha is always pointed to us like, as the outer, so the inner, as the inner, so the outer. And I can see with these systems of oppression that there are also internal systems of oppression, Yeah. And perhaps you might have them too. And they are, familiar, and there's a certain comfort, perhaps, or it's not a comfortable comfort, but a familiar comfort. And there's a certain sense of, well, this is known and the other is not known. So there's a wanting to lean. I mean, I don't really want to, but there can be a wanting to lean back into what's known and shy away from the unknown. So it feels to me like an invitation, not just for changing outer structures, but also to look at, what are the inner structures of oppression that we have here within our own hearts. We can give very broad things like greed, hatred, and delusion. We can have them just sort of throw that out. Yes, of course, and greed, hatred, and delusion. Yes, that will be there. Those will be part of it, sure. But they're very general terms, and it's more useful to get specific. So I feel like at this time, I know that for some people, COVID has given more work than you had before, and for others, it's given more time. But it is, it's kind of keeping us at home, and hopefully, in our lives, we can make some time for very sincere introspection, to really like look within, and to in an interested and curious way. See, what is it that is, do we have something? Is there something within you that is holding you back, that's pulling you down, that's keeping you stuck in old familiar patterns that perhaps you anymore? So this is a, it's not a, it's not a, it's not like a 5-minute exploration. It's maybe a little scary. Might be a little scary to enter the territory. because we don't, because it is inviting, it's like to do that means we have to be okay with not knowing what's next, you know, who we are without those systems. And that also is reflecting on structure, you know, how structures are needed and useful and necessary. And so structures of, you know, all kinds of structures get built, structures of social structures and structures of relationship and structures of physical structures, all kinds of things get created. And then sometimes, you know, those structures, they can be really, really supportive. They can be amazingly helpful and supportive for a period of time, and then there can come a time when they're no longer supportive. So that might be that somebody can move out of the structure because it's no longer supportive, or it might be that the whole structure needs to fall apart. And we don't know what's going to be next, and that's kind of a bit scary. It does feel a bit like we're in one of those times right now. And so it's the same with the internal work. There may be structures that you have used that are really useful, that have been good, and they may not be serving you anymore. And if they are still serving you, then great, you know, take care of them and use them well. That's right. But if they're not, if they're keeping you too solid, too certain, too separate, then it's time to start to turn towards them and investigate them, tease them apart a bit, and see what's holding that together. What's that there for? And if you're lucky enough to have good friends around, you can let them know what you're doing and ask them for help. They don't even, the wonders now, they don't even have to be nearby. They can have a Zoom call with them. But it's great if you have one or two friends who are really deep friends, good friends who you trust and give you really kind of difficult feedback, and it doesn't, you know, it's not cut, it doesn't hurt, or maybe it's the kind of hurt that is the growthful hurt. Then let them know what you're doing, and work with them to help undo those old patterns of limitation. So that's for me, this, it feels like this is a time that's inviting that. Because if we're still using the same old harmful patterns or destructive patterns or limiting patterns, fear, anger, and dominance, or dissociation, or any of those things, the various ways we avoid or shrink back, then you know, we're not serving our own path fully, and we're also in a way like, well, it doesn't allow like the free flow of energy that can be there when we're not all blocked up with all of those things. And for me, the Noble Eightfold Path is a beautiful tool or a beautiful framework. Speaking of structures, is a beautiful framework for investigating what's going on. And you know, you might want to, you know, each of us will have something different, you know, or even if it's the same thing, it'll be, you know, from a different perspective. So it's a very individual work, but I think the Eightfold Path is a beautiful guide. And the first fold of the path of the Four Noble Truths is an understanding impermanence is gives us a very practical way of transforming stuckness. We see how the suffering is being created, and first we feel it, but then we recognize how it's being created, and then we let go. We find out how to let go of the cause of dukkha. And then right thought, you know, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-harm and non-ill will. It's something I sometimes use like as a mantra, with a little bit of a question, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-harm, non-ill will. And then just seeing like what is the mind doing? Is it just ruminating over things, grumbling about things, and criticizing, and being, you know, greedy about this or that? Or, and then, so what would it be like for the mind to be having thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of putting down? What would it be like to be having thoughts of harm, wishing that all beings be free from harm, any intention to harm? And what would it be like to have thoughts of metta, good wishes? And it's like it makes the invitation for the mind to change. And then that supports right speech. So for me, right speech has sort of popped up as a hello. This is the way you need to do some work, you know. And okay, this is a very big piece of work. It's like not that this is new, and of course I have done a certain amount of work in the past. But it's like, oh, now and there's another level of work that needs to be done here. That and it's time for this. So, you know, you may find there may be something for you that's even something that's very ordinary and something that's is not new, or something that's that you thought you'd done already, you were kind of good with, and the spiral has come back around to that place again where it needs some more work. You may have something too. I don't know. But I'd like to invite everyone who's on this call to spend some time to look, you know, and not just to look at what's wrong and what needs to be fixed, because it's not about becoming a perfect person. We never get there. But to appreciate all the work that is done, and to appreciate the good that's here, to see that. And also that's that good friend, if you have a good friend, you can ask them also to, you know, tell you something good if they don't volunteer it. So that we can see what's good here. You don't want to just look at what's missing and what's wrong. And then within that context, to see like, oh, and what needs to be developed? So the Asala Puja is the day before our rains retreat, our Vassa, 3 month Vassa. And often the Vassa is a time to pick up a practice in particular and really take care around it. And also for us, it's also the time to go more deeply into the Vinaya. So it could be for you a time to look at the precepts and how you live them, and how they support you, and how they and where they're difficult for you, and to really just take them on a little more deeply. So it's a training, it's a developing, it's a letting go. So I'd like to offer that. I hope there's something useful. And open up for if people have any questions.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.